And more times than I can count, I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. Today, the latest on your heart and how even in your 20s and 30s, you're now susceptible to heart disease because of the toxic environment that we live in, the choices we make. Now, of course, that's not true for everyone. Many people, millions of people, are very conscious of the choices they make, young or old, and that's why they are not suffering the same conditions. But as a whole, we're a very sick society. Bill Falloon from Life Extension shared a very important report on atherosclerosis, and I'm going to share that with you. Then I want to talk about why you should engage in regular aerobic activity if you're a woman over the age of 40. And also talk about how aloe vera can help with Alzheimer's and improve cognition. And also, dietary supplements are part of a healthy lifestyle, according to the latest studies, have a lot to share on health and healing, always from mainstream peer-reviewed journals. Then, from our environmental segment, I'm going to share a piece from Naomi Klein from The Guardian. It's entitled, Why the United States fracking companies are licking their lips over the Ukraine. From climate change to Crimea, the natural gas industry is supreme at exploiting crisis for private gain, what I call the shock doctrine. So we'll explore that. Makes a lot of sense. And then from Professor Henry Giroux, Neoliberalism and the Machinery of Disposability, a special commentary. Then I'm going to open the lines at that point for comment and feedback on any of the discussion points for today. And then I'm going to talk, if time permits, and I'm not sure it will, about how certain corporations colonized our public life, how they did it fully complicit with politicians that have delegated power to global giants, engineering a world of conformity and consumerism. So we have a lot to discuss. Let's begin. I grew up in a rather large extended family. Between all my aunts and uncles, the most common cause of death was heart attack, followed by cancer. And later, when I would see the role that lifestyle played, and smoking in particular, and drinking, it was no surprise. Many of my best friends growing up smoked and drank. In fact, all but one of all the people I knew growing up lived a very unhealthy lifestyle as far as their diet. Now, they exercised a lot. All of us did growing up because being an athletic participant was, it was accepted and expected. But exercising when you're young will help you for about another 10 years. But it doesn't help you indefinitely. And just like if you stopped smoking 10 years ago, that's a great thing, but it will ultimately mean that you're going to get cancer at some point in your life or some form of respiratory condition because of the damage done when you were smoking. The same is true with drinking. You'll damage your liver and your kidneys early in life, more often now because of college drinking and binge drinking and combination of drugs taken with that, and frequently antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication, which is rampant in colleges. And let's say you get out and you become aware that you're no longer under the pressure to pass grades or to graduate at a certain place in your class. And so that eases back. And you begin to take more interest in your health. If you don't do something to undo the damage done sooner rather than later, it'll manifest. I'll give you an example of this. In 1 5-day period, I counseled 5 women who were in their 40s, mid-40s, who all, for all intents and purposes, if you spoke with them, were living extraordinarily healthy lifestyles. They were conscious of their exercise and juicing and supplements and diet. And yet they were, and they didn't know each other. This just, I just found it rather interesting that week. Why do these women all suffer from fatigue? No matter how much they sleep, they're still tired. And so the following week, I gave them an all-call. I said, have you had any blood workups done to see whether or not you have any viruses, such as hepatitis? Well, I wouldn't have hepatitis. I haven't done anything to create hepatitis. They all five had hepatitis, hepatitis B or C. And that's why they were feeling fatigued. But they hadn't been fatigued in their 30s, and it was in their 20s when all of them, when further questioned, had taken drugs or experimented in life with things that were curious to them, but later it created hepatitis. And hepatitis plays havoc with the liver. And when you have a defective liver and you have core antigens and you have active markers, you're going to be fatigued. I think people should be tested for hepatitis. I believe that we have a lot more people having hepatitis from earlier life experiences, even though they change later in life. Sooner or later, everything you do is going to come knocking. So now we look at what about our hearts, because the number one cause of physical death in the United States from a disease, iatrogenesis number one, that's medically induced. But for number two, number three would be heart disease, heart attacks and stroke. And at the top of that list, you have atherosclerosis. Atherosclerosis is the term used to describe damage and obstruction to the lining of our arteries. When arterial blood flow is impeded or blocked, the result can be death or disability from a stroke or heart attack. A misconception about atherosclerosis is that it is a modern-day scourge caused by unhealthy habits. I've heard so-called experts claim that people didn't suffer coronary artery disease in the past because their diets were so natural. These so-called experts had no basis to claim that atherosclerosis is a modern-day phenomena. All they could cite was that few people developed heart disease in the past compared to today. Now, the reason more people weren't having heart attacks back then was that most died before the age of 50 from diseases that are now preventable and easily curable. In fact, a study on this topic published in The Lancet last year attracted worldwide media attention. It documented that mummified human bodies dating back 4,000 years and spanning multiple geographic locations and cultures suffer from clogged arteries. Yes. And so atherosclerosis is a disease of aging that has always been prevalent. It took MRI imaging to document clear signs of heart disease in 34% of mummified humans whose estimated mean age was about 43 when they died. And those who died at an estimated mean age of 32 were less likely to show signs of atherosclerosis. Just go back to 1900. In 1900, the number one cause of death was pneumonia. Number two was tuberculosis. Then diarrhea and enteritis. Diarrhea mainly because of bad milk. Back then, what you would have is you would have hundreds, even thousands of small farms milk the cows, and then in their buckets, and these were not sanitized buckets, they were never sterilized. They may have been washed, but the bacteria from the milk was still breeding in there. And none of their cows were ever inspected. There were no inspections in the country. And so when you bring a large container of milk to a central depot and they weigh it, and then they pour it into a gigantic tank, so you could have the milk from thousands and thousands of cows all going into one tank, and that's what where people got their milk. And if there was one single cow that was infected with mastitis or had bacteria, because they didn't wash the udders back then, I remember going up 3:30 in the morning, 4 o'clock at the latest, going out and going to about 17 cows, and you first took a hose and you washed down the udder, and you washed off the teats, and then you put up a wooden stool and a bucket, and the bucket was on the wall, and you milked, and the dogs and cats would line up, sitting obediently waiting for you to squirt some more in their mouths, and that's how I remember as a kid, and we would take that milk on Saturdays into the local place that would pay for it and use it. But imagine 50, 60 years before then, you didn't have the inspections. You had no way of telling if there was bacteria. They couldn't test for it. They had no way of testing for the different microorganisms we know today, and nobody washed the cow udder. So diarrhea was a very common third cause of death. And then you got heart disease and stroke further down. Cancer was way down. But today, heart disease and cancer and stroke are number one, two, and three. And you don't have tuberculosis on the top list at all. In fact, chronic lung disease, there's your smoking and pollution. Accidents, pneumonia and influenza, diabetes, these are the others that are right up there. So what we have is we have our blood vessels diseased, and we're not even aware of it. Now, these findings help confirm that atherosclerosis has always been widespread, but the good news is there's a lot we can do about it. First and foremost, let's try to simplify it. In seeking to identify what causes atherosclerosis in the mummified bodies, the Lancet researchers speculated that it could have been high levels of inflammation these primitive people were exposed to from constant infections and non-hygienic environments. You got to understand something. I mentioned about 2 weeks ago how a movie theater, a very, you know, popular movie theater, every single seat was contaminated with feces and other bacteria. And you think, well, how's that possible? Well, it's very possible if you don't practice proper hygiene and you simply wipe after defecation instead of washing with soap and water, because you have oil glands, you have sweat glands, and microorganisms move, and they're propelled by friction and standing, sitting, walking, jogging. That all causes that to move and goes right through the underwear, through the pants, and into whatever seat that you're sitting on. But no one ever cleans the seats. When was the last time you ever thought about what was on a seat that you were sitting on? And yet we should. Most Americans don't wash their hands. Many doctors, nurses, and orderlies don't wash their hands in the hospitals. We had 100,000 Americans die of infections in the hospitals. Now, wouldn't you think that with people with the level of education and awareness of bacteriology, virology, infection diseases, that they would be the first example of having very low incidence of negligence? But they have one of the highest levels of negligence. Think how many times you touch a doorknob, you touch money, you touch any form of handles, desks. That's how you get infection. Now imagine all the school kids who get sick and pass the sickness around to other kids and take it home with them. Because who goes into a classroom and sprays a tabletop with hydrogen peroxide and alcohol, wipes it down, takes seconds so that you could lessen the contact? We don't. So now imagine a culture that didn't have toilet paper, didn't have running water, didn't have bathrooms, had no way of washing the food that they were eating. They might have brushed off some dirt, but they didn't wash it off. There was virtually no hygiene. In fact, I haven't finished it yet. I've written a script for a short film that I'm doing on what it would be like to live in Versailles in the community. There were about 1,800 retainers to the crown that resided there, and then the village around it that supported it, that grew the food and tended to the details. And at each level, from the king and queen and the court retainers to the bureaucrats, the functionaries, to the peasants, and how they actually lived in a day, taking one single day in their lives. What did they do when they woke up in the morning if they had no toilets and no water right away? To where did they go? Where do people go to the bathroom? How do you get rid of it? What do you do to brush your teeth if there are no toothbrushes and no toothpaste? And most people couldn't afford soap. And most people had very few clothes. Most people never bathed. What about head lice? What about bed bugs? What about food? Where did you keep food if you went to the fish market and got fish, knowing the fish biodegrades very quickly? And at the Royal Court, how would it have been in the summertime when you had had to wear your wig and all your garments, multiple garments for the women, and these were extremely uncomfortable, but your body would have been just been soaking. It would be like as if we today were to dress up in, you know, a whole lot of clothes and then go into a sauna. That's what it would have been like. Imagine the smells. Well, who wasn't affected? Where were the dogs and cats kept? You'd be surprised at how many palaces actually had animals in the palaces and put straw on the floor, which they swept out twice a year. We glamorize it. We romanticize it. We make it seem wonderful, this bucolic or this ancient romantic lifestyle. It was not. People lived very short lives. If you lived in the country and you happened to have had a well that was not polluted with arsenic, natural arsenic, and you ate good foods, then there was a lifetime that you could live that would be probably 15 years longer than those living in the city. That's why Henry VIII lived a longer life, but not exceptionally long. So we have to understand. Anyhow, I'm going to finish that because I think it'd be interesting for people to see total lack of hygiene. Everybody stunk. Their body stunk, their breath stunk, their teeth were rotted, their gums were infected, and there was no hygiene at all. It would be an extraordinarily gross society. So we should appreciate that in many respects, many people have not evolved a whole lot further today when it comes to hygiene. So you eat bad food, you eat bacteria in the food, you get inflammation. You get a serious inflammation, you can die from it. So, people in America are loaded with inflammation. Rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, inflammation. Diabetes, inflammation. Cancer, inflammation. Bursitis, inflammation. Macular degeneration. Free radicals that cause oxidative stress. Brain aging, inflammation. So, you see, chronic inflammation is a primary cause of stroke and heart attack. A study published last year corroborated this. The investigators reported on a large group of older individuals who were followed for 17 years. Those with the highest levels of inflammatory blood markers were 300% more likely to suffer sudden cardiac death as those with the lowest levels. Now, the recent CDC report did not factor in on reporting on how bad all this was, chronic inflammation as an avoidable cause, because we can avoid this. And you just have to look in your arteries. So why is atherosclerosis so common? We know that excess dietary intake of the wrong kinds of fats and sugars damage arterial lining. So does tobacco. Alcohol does the same. And overlooked is the continuous toxic exposure in arteries to cellular waste products that are released into the bloodstream for filtration and excretion primarily through the kidneys. Now, most of us are born with a flawlessly intact endothelial that lines our arteries and protects against formation of atherosclerosis. As we age, our arterial linings endures chronic insult from internal and external factors that results in loss of blood flow to the heart, the kidneys, and the brain. Now, this is the leading reason why most aging people today become disabled and then prematurely die. Excuse me, die. Those who understand the many causes of atherosclerosis should not be surprised. It is so common. What's appalling is the number of people who continue to succumb to atherosclerosis diseases because of widespread physician apathy, and most doctors are just as dumb as bricks when it comes to anything in prevention or hygiene. Multiple culprits initiate and promote atherosclerosis. They share in common an ability to damage the delicate endothelium that lines our vascular system. An early step in the initiation of atherosclerosis is often reduced nitric oxide availability, then bioavailability, that initiates endothelial dysfunction. Aging results in further impairment in the ability to synthesize endothelial nitric oxide that markedly accelerates atherosclerosis. So how can we reverse this? How can we prevent it? First and foremost, stop the crash diets. The most popular books today are diet books. And the emphasis is upon losing weight, not on getting healthy. And the high-protein diets are, without exception, the most dangerous diets ever. You could lose weight, but you could damage the kidneys, the endothelium, the liver, the heart, the brain in the process. We should be looking at plants that turn off inflammation and actually heal DNA, such as green tea, red grapes, pomegranate. All of those protect nitric oxide production, thus helping to restore youthful function and structure to our endothelial artery linings. It is somewhat contradictory, however, for one to gobble down enormous amounts of anything and then ignore other proven factors that silently destroy endothelial. That's why I don't believe we should just be popping a pill for health. We should be making fundamental, constant changes. Look at your elevated glucose level, insulin, triglycerides, LDL cholesterol, homocysteine, C-reactive protein, oxidative stress, the low HDL and low testosterone in men. They inflict their own unique forms of endothelial damage. It is thus critical to have your blood tested annually to ensure that none of these destroyers are present. So how do we go about slowing down this? Well, first, if you have elevated homocysteine, it's been linked to atherosclerosis, and it's not difficult to get that. Get off the meat, get off the dairy, get off the alcohol in any amount. Then start taking lots of beans and grains, nuts and seeds, but also supplement with 1 milligram of methylated B12, milligram of folic acid, about 400 to 500 milligrams at the high end. No, go down 200 milligrams of vitamin B6 and 1,000 milligrams of trimethylglycine. That could protect you from a heart attack. And scientists long ago documented the ability of the good HDL, the high-density lipoprotein, to remove cholesterol affixed to arterial walls and transport it to the liver for safe disposal. And this is why it is so important to maintain HDL levels that above 50 milligrams per deciliter of blood, and that's not difficult to do. HDL does more than just cleanse arterial walls of plaque. It also protects the LDL against oxidation while inhibiting chronic inflammation, vascular adhesion molecules, and platelet activation, all factors that lead to atherosclerosis. Exercising, pomegranates, that's how you do that. So that's one way that we can help our bodies to reduce the bad LDL, reduce triglycerides, reduce glucose, reduce C-reactive protein, reduce measures of liver damage, reduce blood pressure, reduce hemoglobin A1C, and increase the good HDL. It's that simple. I'm Gary Knoll, here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. One other thing for women who are over the age of 40. According to the British Journal of Sports Medicine, if you exercise aerobically 5 days a week, you can boost the size of the area of the brain involved in verbal memory and learning, and that's part of our intellectual capacity, and that diminishes as we age, so that is important for you. Exercise makes an enormous difference. Aloe vera has also been shown in the University of Miami School of Medicine research published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease to impact the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease and even increase cognitive scores. So you want to help if you know someone in your family who has Alzheimer's or dementia, have them take whole leaf aloe 2 to 3 times a day. Now to our environmental segment. This is from Naomi Klein. The way to beat Vladimir Putin is to flood the European market with fracked in the USA natural gas. No. That's what the industry would have us believe. As part of escalating anti-Russian hysteria, two bills have been introduced into the U.S. Congress, one in the House of Representatives, H.R. 6, and one in the Senate, S-2083, that attempt to fast-track liquefied natural gas exports, all in the name of helping Europe to wean itself from Putin's fossil fuels and enhancing U.S. national security. According to Cory Gardner, the Republican congressman who introduced the House bill, quote, opposing this legislation is like hanging up on a 9/11 call from our friends and allies. That might be true as long as your friends and allies work at Chevron and Shell, and the emergency is the need to keep profits up amid dwindling supplies of conventional oil and gas. For this ploy to work, it's important not to look too closely at details, like the fact that much of the gas probably won't make it to Europe, because what the bills allow is for gas to be sold on the world market to any country belonging to the World Trade Organization. Or the fact that for years the industry has been selling the message that Americans must accept the risks to their land, their water, and air that come with hydraulic fracturing in order to help their country achieve energy independence. And now, suddenly and slyly, the goal has been switched to energy security, which apparently means selling a temporary glut of fracked gas on the world market, thereby creating energy dependencies abroad. And most of all, it's important not to notice that building the infrastructure necessary to export gas on this scale would take many years in permitting and construction. One single terminal will cost about $7 billion and must be fed by a massive interlocking web of pipelines, compressor stations, and requires its own power plant just to generate energy sufficient to liquefy the gas through supercooling. By the time these massive industrial projects are up and running, Germany and Russia may well be fast friends. But by then, few will remember that the crisis in Crimea was the excuse seized upon by the gas industry to make its long-standing export dreams come true, regardless of the consequences to the communities getting fracked or to the planet getting cooled. I call this knack of exploiting crisis for private gain the shock doctrine, and it shows no signs of retreating. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. In today's New York Times, I saw a front page story, and I'll read the headline from Liz Alderman and Landon Thomas. It says, "Taking a risk, investor snap up once shun Greek debt." Quote, "Investor shun Greek bonds at the height of the European economic crisis, fearful that the region's sickest nation would collapse from its financial woes." But on Thursday, pension funds, banks, and other big money managers were snapping up billions of dollars of new Greek debt and trying to get their hands on even more. Greece's return to the bond market after 4 years adds to the growing optimism that the most troubled nations in the Eurozone are finally recovering from the wretched downturn. But in their rush to profit, investors are putting aside the still fragile economic situation and rampant joblessness that continues to plague Greece and others. The disconnect reflects their near insatiable appetite for higher-paying investments around the globe. With interest rates at record lows, investors are aggressively hunting for returns wherever they can find them, even if risks abound. While the Greece sold $4.2 billion of bonds Thursday, demand for the debt was five times that amount. And, quote, "Investors don't look to the long-term health of economies." That was at one end of it. At the other end of it is what I see as excessive violence, the harassing, the bullying, the breakdown of social decorum. I also see the exploitation of those who have the least. I see the militarization of the police, and I see the corruption of our body politic. When you put all these together, what we have is we have so many people and you will see this in a series of films I am doing. The first will come out this August on poverty. I wish you could be with me when I'm going through a community that has been virtually abandoned for all intents and purposes. The media will never come there. There's no one advocating for its recovery. And yet, it is loaded with people. There are millions upon tens of millions of people living in abject poverty in the United States. Children leave school each day, or 600,000 minimally, have no home to return to. Do we ever wonder, where do they sleep? Where do their parents or parent, find a place for them to have a meal? How do they get their clothes cleaned? The simple necessities of life that many of us take for granted, these people don't. And yet, why aren't their concerns ours? I believe it is because of what Professor Henry Giroux calls neoliberalism and disposability. Now, let's be more specific. And I'm sure that this audience in particular can appreciate this. Because under the regime of neoliberalism, which is rampant, it is what both the corporate Democrats and the corporate Republicans, the mass media, all subscribe to, especially in the United States, war has become an extension of politics, as almost all aspects of society have been transformed into a combat zone. Americans now live in a society in which almost everyone is spied on, considered a potential terrorist, and subject to a mode of state and corporate lawlessness in which the arrogance of power knows no limits. The state of exception has become normalized. Moreover, as society becomes increasingly militarized and political concessions become relics of a long-abandoned welfare state hollowed out to serve the interests of global markets, the collective sense of an ethical imagination and social responsibility toward those who are vulnerable or in need of care is now viewed as a scourge or pathology. I'm sure that you have noticed, or at least heard, about the man who was just minding his own business out of New Mexico. We saw the video of the police, all heavily armed, all with vests protective to their bodies. This man had no protection, and they had their high-powered rifles aimed at him. And yet, as he was starting to come down towards them from his little camping place, they shot him and killed him. Why? You've seen it. I've seen it. And we ask, why? Why? Because we allow it. Because we consider the man the pathology. You don't see people being shot like this. You don't see people being shot in the upper enclaves of Connecticut in the multi-billionaire mansions, do you? No. But here you do. What has emerged in this new historical conjuncture is an intensification of the practice of disposability, in which more and more individuals and groups are now considered excess, consigned to zones of abandonment, surveillance, incarceration. Moreover, this politics of disappearance has been strengthened by a fundamental intensification of increasing through new modes of spying and smothering. Virtually all environmental groups, all peace activist groups, in fact, almost all groups that in any way petition for or protest against or boycott major corporations or governmental agencies are infiltrated and spied upon. They're considered by the FBI as terrorists. And yet we tolerate this. Why? It's all embracing market-driven power for commodification and consumption. Citizens are now reduced to data, consumers, and commodities, and as such inhabit identities in which they increasingly become unknowables, with no human rights and with no one accountable for their condition. Within this machinery of social death, not only do we have a moral blindness prevailing on the part of the financial elite, but the inner worlds of the oppressed are constantly being remade under the force of economic pressures and the culture of fear. Watch what happens to these farmers, these ranchers out in New Mexico, where the government has now decided to use its full force and power to challenge them. No one looks at the origins of this conflict. but now it will have some form of flashpoint in our consciousness. Economists such as Paul Krugman and Robert Reich have argued that we are in a gilded age, a new gilded age, one that mimics a time when robber barons and strikebreakers ruled and the government and economy were controlled by a cabal that was rich, powerful, and ruthless. And of course, blacks, women, and working class were told to mind their own place in a society controlled by the rich. You're there to serve. You're there only to serve. What is often missing in these analyses is that what is new in the second Gilded Age is not just about the moral sanctioning of greed, the corruption of politics by big money, and the ruthlessness of class power. No. What is unique is the rise of a brutal, punishing incarceration state that imposes its power on the dispossessed, the emergence of a surveillance state that spies on and suppresses dissenters, the emergence of a vast cultural apparatus that colonizes subjectivity in the interest of the market, and a political class that is uninterested in political concessions and appears immune from control by nation states. The Second Gilded Age is really a more brutal form of authoritarianism driven by what psychologist Robert J. Lifton, who I've had on this program, rightly calls a death-saturated age, in which matters of violence, survival, and trauma now infuse everyday life. Discarded by the corporate state, dispossessed by social provisions, and deprived of the economic, political, and social conditions that enable viable and critical modes of agency, expanding populations of Americans now find themselves inhabiting zones of abandonment, marked by deep inequalities in power, wealth, and income. Such zones are sites of rapid disinvestment, places marked by endless spectacles of violence and supportive of the neoliberal logics of containment, commodification, surveillance, militarization, cruelty, and punishment. If you doubt me, come next week when I visit and film in Camden, New Jersey. Come with me to the 9 to 10 times I visited Detroit. Come and see what I see and am filming, where you have large segments of the population who are simply considered no longer of any value whatsoever, unless the land can be exploited or unless it can be gentrified. Unless there could be some economic advantage, they no longer exist. These zones of hardships and terminal exclusion constitute a hallmark, signature, and intensification of neoliberal politics of a disposability that is relentless in the material and symbolic violence it wages against the 99%. But we don't have 99%. We realistically have 85%, because 15% are doing fine. You have 8 million millionaires, you have almost 1,400 billionaires, and you also have in the neighborhood of about 25 million upper-middle-class people. Not that they do not deserve what they have. They work hard for it. I do not question how they work for it, because every time I have conversations, most of them have worked diligently. They're not the problem. It is the super-wealthy that are the problem. It is those that are craven sociopaths or psychopaths that manipulate the talking points, that control all dialogue on what is appropriate or inappropriate. These are the ultimate financial elite and the corporations they control. One could say that capitalist expropriation, dispossession, and disinvestment has reached a point where life has become completely unbearable for over half of the American population who are living in or near poverty. And yet, when was the last time on any major network, on 60 Minutes, on 2020, on MSNBC, on Fox, when did you hear someone showing how many jobs have been offshored in the last 30 years? The power of the equity partnerships, the hedge funds, the people who make money off money, the people who live in debt because they can control debt and they profit from it, where someone else is always at risk, but never themselves, where whenever they fail, they're bailed out. They're politically connected through the presidents, through the stay-behinds. Each administration keeps anywhere from 12 to 2,000 people behind in important positions, frequently taking them from the private sector into government service, where they then act as those that continue to protect the order that was established before them. And yet these people cannot fail. Their corporations cannot fail. They will always be bailed out. The newest law that we're seeing is that all banks will be bailed out. by 90%. They only have to be responsible for 10%. Have you been told this? Have I been told this? No. And yet we cannot stop a single home foreclosure based upon ethical grounds. I remember my Aunt Virginia was an officer at the Parkersburg National Bank, and she once told me the story of why during the Great Depression she chose not to foreclose on a family house, several. And she went to the bank president. She said, how can you throw these people out of their homes? Because they are sitting beside you and me in the pews on Sunday in our church. This is not Christian. This is not what Christ would do. And I cannot do this, and I will not do it. And she didn't. And those people, at least, had their homes not foreclosed on. Well, I'm sure that there are other people at different times who also felt similarly. But then in the last 20 years, where are they? Where's the greatest generation when we need them? The baby boomers, my generation, the most greedy bunch of bastards in history. We've created this entire mess, and we do take no responsibility for it. Shame on us. I wish that were a million of my aunts alive today, because we would have an ethical world that we could live in, where people cared about one another. So tell me, please, I'd like to know, which president, which senator, which House member stood up and said, I will no longer support any action unless it supports the American people, and we must stop them from being thrown out of their houses, put a moratorium on all home foreclosures, reduce the cost of their mortgage to the value of their property, and let them stay. Who has been that person? The promises regarding progress, freedom, and hope have not been eliminated completely, but in most cases they have. They have been reconfigured, stripped of their emancipatory potential, and subordinated to the logic of a savage market, instrumentality, and individualization of the social. Dispossession and disinvestment have invalidated the promises and have turned progress into a curse for the marginalized and a blessing for the superfinancial elite. And they have reneged on the undertaking to fulfill the social contract, however disingenuous or limited, especially with regards to young people. Long-term planning and the institutional structures that support them are now weakened, if not eliminated, by the urgencies of privatization, deregulation, flexibility, and short-term investments. That's why I read the New York Times. Do you see any report in the New York Times on the irony that none of these wealthy investors or people and the retirement funds and the pension funds that want to gobble up these bonds, when did they also suggest that they put their money into rebuilding Greece's infrastructure, regaining the opportunity there by investment to start companies and businesses that would gainfully employ the people of Greece, where they could help rebuild their infrastructures? They have not done that at all, because that would mean investing in people. Instead, they're investing in money. And that's why I've said many times, if every single bank, every single company, if every single person on Wall Street were to stop today and never be employed there again, and all those banks closed, it would not impact the average person at all. We've been lied to. We've been manipulated, especially by the Democrats, and by being told we must save these people. We should never have saved these people. But we did. Why? Because we are immersed in the cult of neoliberalism's disposability, and it's relentlessly engaged in the production of an unchecked notion of individualism that both dissolves social bonds and removes any viable notion of agency from the landscape of social responsibility and ethical considerations. Absorbed in privatized orbits of consumption, commodification, and display, Americans vicariously participate in the toxic pleasures of a mode of authoritarianism characterized by the reactionary presence of the corporate state, the concentration of power and money in the upper percentage of the population, and the ongoing militarization of all aspects of society. In its current historical conjuncture, the authoritarian state is controlled by about 1,400 billionaires and probably another 5,000 or 6,000 multimillionaires and their families. Think of the Waltons, think of the Koch brothers, think of George Soros, and a select class of zombie-like financial and corporate elite who now control the commanding economic, political, and cultural institutions of American society. I was once told I would not be allowed back on Channel 13, PBS, because my message, though it was healthy, went against that of the head of the local station board, who happened to have been a billionaire equity partner who made his money in tobacco. And I said, well, what did that have to do with helping people get a message that could help them heal or prevent disease? And the person simply said, are you not aware that these are the gatekeepers? Look who funds much of the PBS programming. Look who funds NPR. And you will see both self-censorship, and you will see the power of the silent hand of the vulture capitalist. They were right. Mechanisms of governance have been transformed into instruments of war. Violence has become the organizing force of a society driven by toxic notion, a privatization in which it becomes difficult for ideas to be lifted into the public realm. Under such circumstances, politics is eviscerated because it now supports a market-driven view of society that has turned its back on the idea that humanity is never acquired in solitude. That is, society has come undone in terms of the social contract, and in doing so has turned its back on most Americans whose lives and futures are no longer determined by social spaces that give them a voice and provide the conditions for autonomy, freedom, and equality. This violence against the social mimics is not just the death of a radical imagination, but also a notion of banality. The root of totalitarianism was a kind of thoughtlessness, an inability to think, and a type of outrageous stupidity. The plight of disposable populations can be seen in the fact that millions of Americans are unemployed and are receiving no long-term benefits. Shockingly, the only source of assistance for more than 50 million Americans is nothing but a food stamp card. Close to half of all Americans live or beneath the poverty level, while more than 1,600,000 school kids go home to a no home. They have to live in cars or other places. And yet, we do not make this an issue. 50 million Americans are in dire poverty. We do not make it an issue. 57% of all children in the United States are in homes considered to be either low income or impoverished, and half of all American children will be on food stamps at least once before they turn 18. Yet it's not an issue. At the time, the 400 richest Americans have as much wealth as 154 million Americans combined. Yet that's not an issue of inequality. Within this system of power and disposability, the ethical grammars that draw our attention to the violence of such suffering disappear while dispossessed populations lose their dignity, their bodies, and their material goods and homes. The fear of losing everything, the horror of the engulfing precarity, the quest to merely survive, and the impending reality of social and civil death have become a way of life for the vast majority of 85% of the American population. Under the politics of disposability, the grammars of suffering, cruelty, and punishment have replaced the value of compassion, social responsibility, and civic courage. The severity of the consequences of this shift in neoliberalism among youth is evident in the fact that it is the first generation in which the plight of the outcast may stretch for at least two generations. Today's youth have been cast in a condition of limited drift. Youth no longer occupy a hope of a privileged place that was offered to all of us who preceded them. They now inhabit a neoliberal notion of temporarity marked by a loss of faith in progress, along with the emergence of an apocalyptic narrative in which the future appears indeterminate, bleak, and insecure. Heightened prospects and progressive visions pale and are smashed next to the normalization of market-driven government policies that wipe out pensions, eliminate quality health care, raise college tuition, and produce a harsh world of joblessness while giving millions to banks and the military. Students in particular now find themselves in a world in which heightened expectations have been replaced by dashed hopes and a world of onerous debt. What has changed about an entire generation of young people includes not only neoliberal society's disinvestment in youth and the permanent fate of downward mobility, but also the fact that youth live in a commercially carpeted, bombed, commodified environment that is unlike anything experienced by those of previous generations. Nothing has prepared this generation for the inhospitable and savage new world of commodification, privatization, joblessness, frustrated hopes, surveillance, and stillborn projects. The present generation has been born into a throwaway society of consumers in which both goods and young people are viewed increasingly as redundant and disposable, where they are merely valued as consumers and commodities. In this discourse, young people are not seen as troubled, but viewed as a source of trouble. Rather than viewed as being at risk, they are the risk and subject to a range of punitive policies. The structures of neoliberal society do more than disinvest in young people and commodify them. They also transform the protected space of childhood into a zone of disciplinary exclusion and cruelty, especially for those youth who are further marginalized by race and class, who now inhabit a social landscape in which they are increasingly disparaged as flawed consumers. With no adequate role to play as consumers, many youth are forced to inhabit zones of social abandonment, extending from bad schools to bulging detention centers to prisons. Youth have become a market for a mode of disposability in which their fate is defined largely through the registers of a society that throws away resources, people, and goods. These are zones where the needs of young people are not only ignored, but where many young people, especially poor minority youth, are subjected to conditions of impoverishment and punishment that undeserve them and only criminalize them and their behavior. From Professor Henry Giroux, and that is just the beginning. I'm Gary Nall. I want to mention that this coming Sunday at 9 o'clock at 5th Avenue and 90th Street, we're going to have the beginning of our Running and Walking Club. And if for some, it'll be to train for the New York City Marathon, which we'll be doing with you, running, jogging, or race walking. For others, it won't be training for the marathon. It'll be just getting yourself in really good shape. It's free. It's a public service. It'll be at 9 o'clock. Now, here's what's interesting. A week from Sunday, not this Sunday, but a week from Sunday, I'll be doing a very different lecture. And it's based upon a conversation I had with a person who is well-known, I will not reveal the person's identity, who sent me a letter, and then I counseled the person. And I have had a different way of looking at solving problems. It's something new, revolutionary, in my opinion. If you appreciated how different the life energies discussion was and what it meant for you, this even goes further. It's something you have not heard anywhere. I won't discuss more of it than that, but I will be doing that a week from Sunday at 3 o'clock. And if you want to come, and it's based upon a letter that I got called What is Wrong with Women from a woman. Quote, you asked me some thoughts about where women get it wrong in our relating to men. I'd like to begin by joyfully admitting I've made every mistake imaginable. All those mistakes are born from one core error, a paradigmatic mistake that can only produce failure. First of all, I did not know what a woman was, even though I was one. I failed to take responsibility for my own power. I had a deep wound from childhood, like so many of us do. And then went on, it goes on from there. This person makes some really wonderful insights. And what I'm doing is I'm going to be looking at from different women, from all the different conditions that people have found themselves confused, feelings of abandonment or feelings of fear, feelings of pain, feelings of uncertainty of identity, of low self-worth, leading to depression and anxiety, leading to failed relationships. I will relate insights on all this. My hope is that you'll come away with a completely new way of looking at yourself, a very liberating and quantum difference in anything that's been done before. You can call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, if you'd like to attend. That's a week from Sunday, 3 o'clock, here in Manhattan. Let's go to the phone. Say hello to Abby from New York. Hi, Abby.
Hi, Gary. How you doing?
Doing great. Thank you.
Gary, I have been listening to you for 20 years, and I've been really impressed with your evolution politically. I hope you're not offended by me saying that. I used to feel not crazy about your politics when you seemed to be more libertarian-oriented. And it seems that you've evolved incredibly through the experience you've had facing people.
If you think that I've evolved in the last 20 years, good, thank you. I appreciate that. You should go back 20 years before that and listen to the shows and see what you think. Nice to have you on board. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Mm-hmm.